Hey, welcome back. My name is Manoj, your host, and this is the Rare Earth Podcast. Let the conversations begin. I've got an amazing guest for you for this episode. Her name is Priyanka Raghuvanshi. Now, Priyanka is an artist with a truly unique way of looking at things. So in this episode, we really get into Priyanka's story. And trust me, it's been a wild ride. She talks about her twisty journey. Why I call it twisty? Because she started as a student of psychology and all ready to understand how the mind works. And then from there, she goes on to finally realizing that art is her true love. And what's really cool about Priyanka is how she always keeps it real. And you will get a glimpse of that when you're listening to this. During this chat, she really talks about the importance of asking questions. Even if it makes you look a little silly, it's okay. And she says, that's how you grow and figure out who you are. We also dive into some heavy stuff like the good and the bad parts of relationships. We talk about how tough it can get dealing with office drama and why it is so important to be true to yourself no matter what. Priyanka is candid the whole time and her genuine, relatable vibe is something that will be very contagious and you can sense it. Oh, and if you're a lover of history, you're gonna enjoy this episode because Priyanka and I totally geek out about her passion for Indian history. And she shares some mind-blowing thoughts about how politics can really mess the way we look at the past. Believe me, this is an episode you definitely got to hear. Priyanka is unfiltered. Her wisdom and her fresh take on art and life will definitely leave you feeling inspired and maybe even change the way you look at things. So sit back, relax, and join me for this amazing conversation with the incredible Priyanka Raghuvanshi. Hey, Priyanka, welcome to the show. Really happy to have you join the season 3 of the podcast.
Thank you. Thank you so much for calling me. I have to tell you, this is my first podcast and I'm glad it's happening with you because you're making me very comfortable from the get-go.
No, this is really good. I think I want to just share that I first heard you on the AirChat platform where most of my new season 3 guests are coming from. You are one of those voices which is not only about one specific topic. Your range of topics that you speak about is wide, but also you're willing to go deep in each one of those categories, either with a sense of learning something or with an intention of understanding it more better by asking more questions. That really fascinated me about you. And that's why I definitely wanted to dig deeper with you and in a formal setting, ask more questions about you. That's the idea.
I'm actually glad you reached out because, first of all, AirChat, great platform. I'm so glad I met so many people. Of course, you as well. And this internal monologue we have, it allowed me to show the world what's going on inside my mind, and it allowed me to see other people's thoughts. So that has been very enriching for me, and that somebody else thought that it was valuable, and you thought to call me on your show because of this. It's a great thing to me.
It is great for me too, because it's not like we just randomly run into people who have something interesting to say and something which makes you think. So you definitely offer that in most of the discourses that I've heard. Yeah. So, Priyanka, you call yourself an artist, or at least you represent that way to the world. Before you got started into becoming an artist, is there a backstory to you? What did you study and what was your conventional career path? And did you transition to artist fairly recently, or that has been your calling for a long time?
I don't think it's very linear, my path to becoming an artist. And I use the word artist because it's probably easier for people to comprehend when I give them a singular identity to identify myself with. But I wouldn't call myself just an artist. I think I'm just trying to figure things out, which is something my parents would not like to listen to at this point and at this age. But that's just what it is with me. I did psychology honors, and then I was all geared up to do criminal psychology masters in New Zealand. But then I just suddenly decided I didn't want to do that. Mm-hmm. My parents' Jackson. But after that also, it wasn't art for me. It was, I worked in a couple of ad agencies. I worked with content creation. I worked in the political arena. And then finally, I decided that none of them worked out for me. None of them gave me joy. It wasn't like I had any particular problem with money. So I had that freedom to go and see and go and explore things. So for a while, I just decided to drop everything. And it wasn't like I particularly wanted to get to art. Art just came to me. It just happened because I've been drawing since I was in fourth grade. I've just been drawing stuff. In the start, it didn't make sense, but eventually I got used to it. It was somewhat of an expression and outlet for me. So I just very naturally, I ascended onto art. And people liked my paintings when I put them up online. And people liked them when I sold it to them, showed it to them here. So eventually I also ended up selling it to them.
That's the best part. That's the best part. Yeah, amazing. Yeah. So Priyanka, you did say that you have been drawing for almost all your life. And why wasn't that obvious direction that you didn't take? Like, how come you ended up doing psychology and then deciding not to chase it because you were not feeling so fulfilled with that? So why didn't you go to the arts line from the beginning? Was it because of your interest, or was it because how you felt compelled to do something?
No, it's a very practical reason. I just didn't see a career option in it. I was go-getter also in my studies, so I wanted good marks there as well. I was kind of competing with my siblings who were top scorers, so I didn't want to get left behind.
Yeah.
So that in my mind, but also I enjoyed studying things. I enjoyed it as much as I enjoyed art. And when I began art, there was no scope for art in my country at the time as a kid. Because these are not popular fields. You become an engineer, you become a doctor. Psychology itself was not a popular field at the time. So things have changed now. We're almost 20, 23 years later. We're looking at this now. But in retrospect, we can say, I can question myself on why I didn't take that path. But at the time, it just didn't seem possible or practical. I was interested in art, but I was also interested in psychology. I was interested in a little bit in economics. My range was just
all
over the place.
You also, as a matter of fact, as a passing comment, you mentioned you were briefly in politics. I'm curious, was it like, at what capacity did you get involved in that, or were you?
Subjects in my school, especially my electives after 10th grade, that you choose streams. So one of my subjects was political science along with psychology. And we have a very active political history and a very young political history in this country, which is also, and I think people might not realize this, but it's also very active on all levels in society, right from the beginning, from the farmer to a lower middle class person to a middle class person, it's rampant everywhere. And it was difficult not to notice it around me. So when I got to study it, I got very interested. I started building up my knowledge in that arena as well. It wasn't intentional. Again, it just happened. I got interested and I just kept reading. Eventually, I gained a very thorough understanding of the political landscape here. And I started posting my takes on Twitter. And I got approached by a couple of companies to help them analyze content and help them create content. So I was working with consultancies. That's how that happened. But again, not very interesting. It didn't result in personal growth. So I couldn't stay there for long. It was interesting. I stayed there for that time. But apart from that, it's not for me.
Yeah, I want to revisit that point that you mentioned about when you decided to discontinue with psychology or the idea of pursuing it further. How did that conversation go with your folks?
It wasn't tough. I've been good at convincing my parents because my father was interested in getting me into medical, into making me a doctor.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah. He wasn't pushy about it, but he thought it was a good fit for me.
He was inclined.
Yeah. But which I still vehemently disagree with, because I would still faint at the sight of blood. And I wouldn't want anyone to go through that when I'm operating on them. I will look at them and I will leave my scissors in their stomach. So I was scared about that. And also, I don't know, it felt boring to me. So I convinced him that I wanted to take psychology instead, which was very interesting to me at the time.
Yeah.
He believed in me. My mother believed in me. And my sister obviously helped me convince them. I ended up doing honors, but when I was in the field, we were reading theory, but we were not seeing any application of it in the real world. And I just wondered what I can do with this information that I have now. I have used psychology as a subject to try and understand people's mental landscape, but beyond that, it has no use to me. Again, I don't see any scope for personal growth. So at the end of my honors, when I'm all geared up for my master's in psychology in New Zealand, a month before, all documents, everything prepared, I tell my father, I do not want to do this.
Oh, man.
And he just looks at me with a blank face. Are you for real? I have taken out loans. I have done this. I've done that. I've done everything. Are you for real? And I said, you can be damn sure I am. That's no way I'm going.
Man.
He's been very nice.
I think that speaks a lot about also the way he has parented you guys. I think it's not only about your courage to express that to your folks, but also it speaks a lot about how well he understands you and he was willing to go with what you felt so strongly about. So kudos to him too.
Yeah, he's very different. He's a person who believes in hard work and he's a person who believes in consistency, which I don't have. So for that kind of a person to go along with each of my demands,
yeah,
because
yeah.
He trusts me is a big thing for me. He's been a real nice parent. I have to
Great. I think the reason I was diving a little deep on this particular topic is a lot of our youth today, and most of us went through the phase where we feel strongly about something, but we are unable to express that to our parents. And primarily because the expectation is too high from the parents and they find it too hard to accept any other outcome as a reality. So it was very interesting to see that you were, number one, willing to express that and bring it out, and your folks also agreed. So
I know how tough it is for people to get things through to their parents and how tough it makes for them as well, because eventually you're going to come to a standstill if the child is doing something that they don't like.
Yeah.
And they continue to do it. They'll either get burned out, they'll get hammered into the system, they'll never grow, and they'll be unhappy with themselves. And then they'll turn to blaming the parents. Whether they tell them that or not, they're going to be feeling that. It's a counterproductive thing to do. I think my father recognized that as well.
Mm-hmm.
So he gave me full freedom to explore things, but it's not like he didn't hold me accountable. He's held me accountable all of the times. And he's made sure to tell me that whatever decision you're taking is going to impact your future. So he's had that push and pull with me, but overall he's been very helpful, very supportive. So I'm thankful.
Okay. Awesome. And then we, at least in the air chat community, you're quite popular for your singing skills as well. So you have an amazing voice, and then we totally enjoy what you render there. So do you have an inclination towards music, or were you trained in the music also?
I was actually. So in India, you must be aware of this as well. We generally have girls learning multiple classical dances. It's very common. I know a friend from South who knows all 7-8 of the classical dances. Imagine that, the kind of effort that goes into that.
Wow.
So it was very common putting your children into dance classes, and my mother did the same. So I was learning Kathak. You can call me a post-diploma in Kathak. I was teaching, but I had to retire because of injury. Because in Kathak, you have to make use of your hands more than your feet and hips, which is not the case with other classical dances. And my shoulders are what got injured. So It became very difficult to perform and continue. But I was trained in the dances as well as in classical singing for a very short time though. But from that, I realized that melodies do something to my brain. It does something to my mind. I still can't put my finger on it. If there was a way to map the vibrations that happen inside your body, especially in mind, for me, that would be music. I can imagine my mental landscape flowing in a wave, doing things when music happens to me, which is why I'm also very sensitive to bad music. It upsets me. It really upsets me. People will not understand it around me, but when somebody is just pushing into my ears and my brain that sort of music by playing it loud around me,
Yeah.
I get very upset. But I don't show it. I just move away because maybe that's what interests them. I don't know.
I think, yeah, that the impact of music is sometimes it's very subtle. You go to a certain place and there's an ambient music running at the background. It definitely maybe induces a sense of calmness or anxiety based on what kind of music, but it's very subtle. Many don't realize the influence music has on us, actually. So I do agree with you. And even if you have a playlist of some of the tracks that you really feel very uplifted, in an instant, you could actually change your state, right?
Absolutely. It's one of the things I use to, in fact, uplift my mood or to get into an environment. In fact, you'll hear people saying this all the time here when they sit down to have a drink with their friends. Mahal banao. Matlab, mahal jame. Get into that environment, create that environment. So music is full of that. It's
create the vibe,
Which is, I think, magic.
Totally, totally. All right. So one thing which definitely fascinated me about you is your knack of asking deep questions or profound questions. And you're really remarkable at that. How did you develop that skill? Was it because of your formal education in psychology that helped you hone that? Or it was more of a self-learning process where you discovered? Because you not only are asking good questions to people that you interact with, you also subject yourself to those introspection type questions, right? So can you elaborate on that?
Actually, that is where it comes from, because I keep asking myself questions. I think it was Naval who said this and it stuck with me a couple of years ago. Although I wouldn't call that the beginning of my journey in asking questions. But Naval said that you have to risk looking stupid if you want to gain knowledge. And that is something that I became very comfortable with over time, because not knowing answers to questions was almost torture for me at one point of time. Because, you see, I was stuck with these questions myself. And it stems from the fact that there was a time when I never used to ask questions. I just used to accept things as they are, which caused a different kind of suffering, the kind that it suffocates me. And then I discovered the fact that I could ask questions. So I started with that, but that also brought a different kind of suffering to me, because when I didn't get the answers to those questions, especially when it began with the process of asking questions about mortality, that's a heavy thing to start from.
That is a heavy thing. And just to place in time, so where were you when you started this process of asking questions? Were you in college, or you started working, or it was much earlier?
Difficult to put a finger on it. There has been a subconscious stream of questions in my mind always, but I never paid attention to them. I never became conscious of them. So a part of my frustration was that so many thoughts, so many questions are running inside my head. This has been since I was a kid. This has been there since I was a kid.
Wow.
But since I wasn't paying attention to them, I got frustrated, because society hammers you into becoming something. And when you have questions, you cannot be in sync with that. So either you shut those questions up, or you get out of that system. You become a target. You become a nail that's standing out when other nails are hammered. So in that kind of setup, I first chose to suppress them. That was my natural way of going about things. But eventually, it started frustrating me around college, when I was busy drinking and smoking and just partying. Even at that time, when I had no sense of myself, even at that time, there was this frustration at the back of my head. This was a constant stream, always running through my head. But I will say that when I became alone, when I went in isolation, it truly gave me time to think about these, to pay attention to them, and to pay conscious attention to them. I had no option. I was spending so much time with myself. There was no other way but to face these questions that are inside my head. And like I said, I started with a very heavy thing. It was mortality. And it descended on me. I was reading about space. I was reading about the Advaita philosophy in Hinduism at the same time. And somehow the question of mortality descended on me.
So what exactly was the question that you were contemplating on?
I still am. I really wonder, we talk about the Big Bang as the beginning of our universe, right? And my problem is, I want to know what happened before that. I want to know the origin where everything begins. I'm trying to go as back as possible, but because there is a limit to that.
Yeah.
That frustrates me. And at the time, it frustrated me no end. I can't put into words the kind of suffering that caused me. It changed my thinking. I was with this particular question and other questions that branched out from it all the time. I was with these questions for 1.5 years. I'm sorry.
Wow.
And they made me suffer, but at the same time, they made me less fearful of asking other questions because I began with something so heavy in the first. So that's where my journey began. I still have these questions, but I'm less frustrated by them. I've learned to accept things. Maybe it's because I've grown older than I was. I don't know. Is it age? I don't know if I'm getting more experience. I don't know what it is. I'm less frustrated, but I still have that particular question. I don't have an answer to it. At the same time, I recognized that in society, my tendency to not ask questions, it really wasn't serving me well. At some point of time, I became conscious of that. So I went out of my way to irritate people with questions. So that I could break that mental barrier inside my head.
Yeah, yeah. That must have been a very interesting phase, at least for the people encountering you. I'm curious of how did that go? A completely a new version of you they must have witnessed.
Right. Absolutely. And I'll tell you how it went. I'm not in touch with any of those people.
Okay.
That's how that went.
That helps.
It really wasn't that important for me after all, because asking those questions became more important to me. That's what pushed me. Yeah. Into becoming who I am today, which I'm very happy with.
If a youngster who's just maybe like somebody who's 16, 17 years old were to seek advice with you on this very aspect about questions, even though you very well know that the society really bulldozes you saying that, hey, like just fit into the system, would you still encourage the youngster to just ask more questions and face the criticism and the difficulty of dealing with people and their opinions?
For now, I will not give anyone any advice. And there's a reason for that. Because I think there are many factors in someone's life. Their environment, their family growing up, parents, the relationships they've had. Everything, their journey is their own. If whatever advice I give them, I'm not confident it will help them. So my advice to any person who comes to me seeking advice is, don't take anyone's advice. Just be in your journey. Take things that are useful in your environment that help you. Take words from people who you think are useful. Don't worship those ideas. Don't worship those people. Just take what helps you and just live out your journey. That's the only way to go, for me at least.
Wow, that was beautiful, Priyank. The fact that, yeah, you could have actually given a straightforward answer as an advice, but you added some nuance to it. And that's a fact, right? Everybody is going through so many different situations in life. And how could you just say, you know, one size fits all approach would work? So
absolutely. I've found people who are wiser than I am and who are much younger. So I don't trust myself for now to give anyone any advice. And all I would say is life's happening to everyone. So it's happening to you, it's happening to me. Just live out the way you want to. Just keep your head straight ahead and do what you have to. That's all.
That's amazing. I think that there are some maybe larger frameworks of operating in the world where you know these things kind of work and these some of the things are not effective. So that is something which is like in a practical sense. But when it comes to something more deeper, I think, yeah, there is nuance.
There are frameworks that certainly will work in your favor. But like I said, I think I totally believe that you're capable of breaking every kind of framework.
Mm.
The frameworks that exist, like I was reading The Beginning of Infinity on Naval's recommendation.
Yeah.
And David Deutsch talks about these explanations. And for now, they make sense to a lot of people. And much of what he says makes sense to me. But I'm not taking that as a gospel truth. That's not a truth for me. That's no framework. I'm listening to him. I'm thinking of what the explanations look like, what he's explaining. But because I don't understand them entirely yet, I will not say that this is the framework that works for me. So in that sense, I think you're capable of deconstructing and reconstructing every framework to make it work for you.
So Priyanka, tell me something. Sometimes, do you think we really have to deconstruct and understand everything, or should we just go with the usefulness of something working very well? Like when you're getting into a plane, you wouldn't want to understand the engineering behind plane. You just know that it works. Or when you're just driving on the road, the rules which govern the traffic, it works. And when it is a red, people will stop. Okay, that we can't be sure, too sure about, but we expect people to stop. So do you think we have to really deconstruct and understand at a visceral level that, okay, now I understand it. That's why I'm convinced that this works. Is that the approach useful? I'm just thinking along with you.
I don't know about useful. I think, see, it's whatever feels right to you, whatever feels interesting to you. And it can be anything. That's why people think different. That's why they're unique. That's why there's no two people same on the earth. And there's one person who's looking at that red light and who's thinking, why red? You know? So people analyze different things according to whatever feels interesting to them. Yeah. So whatever you want to deconstruct, deconstruct. But with regards to speaking about larger frameworks that we were talking about,
I think
there are templates, okay, and templates work for some people, they don't. Eventually, if you're going to be doing thinking for yourself, if you're going to create that process yourself about thinking for yourself, then you have to come up with your own template. There is no other framework in the world, none, absolutely none, that will work for you in that case. If you get into the habit of thinking for yourself, if you get into the habit of questioning, you have to come up with your own template. Because if you don't, at least for me, this is the case. If I don't, I'll be lost what to believe and what not to believe. So I pick and choose things that exist and I come up with my own ways. My internal environment is something that only I'm experiencing. So all that I do doesn't have to be available to everybody else, you know?
That
will make no sense to anybody else who sees them. But they work for me. By deconstruction for myself, I would say, when I was coming out from a setup that I didn't want to be in, a framework that I didn't want to be in, I had to break it. And breaking that takes effort, of course. It is sometimes debilitating in the sense that you have to let go of everything that feels familiar to you solely because it's been around for such a long time. Let go of that. You have to let go of everything that works for you and you have to build from scratch. But when you build from scratch for yourself and when you make that template, that framework for yourself, you become much more sure of yourself, of what you're doing. It serves very well. It served me very well.
Do you have an example to share which kind of explains this?
Let's take the example of asking questions that you're talking about. Like I said, I've never seen people around me growing up really questioning things because that's the way things work in the world. And I'm not trying to be poetic about this at all. It's just the way, see, like habits are wired into us to make things that we repeat easier so that our brain doesn't have to think about that, doesn't have that clutter. That's how people function in real life as well. People don't question things because it makes life easier. There's a thing to follow that is less responsibility on self and there's just more of doing, just go with the flow.
Yeah.
For some people that will feel natural, but for me it didn't. And with that framework that I was operating in, slowly I was always clawing at it and I was always breaking it. By the very fact that I didn't like being in it, by being aware of that, by taking one small action on that, asking one question, I was breaking that framework. Eventually, it overflowed. Eventually, when I became alone, when I became isolated, there came a time that I just couldn't work in it and I drastically changed. The person I was 5 years ago, the person I am now, if put the two of them in the same room, they wouldn't recognize each other. They wouldn't even be able to stand each other. That is the kind of change I went through. So this is how it worked for me. For other people, maybe it doesn't work that way.
Yeah.
Maybe everybody's risk-taking capacity, or maybe everybody's willingness, or maybe they're just happy with the way they are. But I wasn't.
Yeah, I think some people, as you said, they do not want to add that cognitive load of changing something which has become a set pattern and they have operated in that particular pattern for years, maybe decades, and then suddenly you introducing the idea about questions disrupts the flow. So they are okay just following that rather than challenging those conventional ideas. So
right, it's less mental load and it's less chaos to deal with.
Yeah, so, yes. No, I think that definitely made sense. There was one related thing which I think you had tweeted fairly recently about that there was a time when you used to follow authority, then you stopped that, and then you were following ideas, then you stopped that, and then now you see the usefulness of something and then you decide whether I'm probably screwing up by what you exactly stated, but can you elaborate on that?
So again, this is a brilliant opportunity to interconnect what I said previously. When we're born into a system, there are structures, there is infrastructure, there are ideas, robust ideas that have been running across generations. When you're born into such a system, naturally, there are things that are presented to you as a truth. You grow up believing them to be true. For example, kids grow up believing that adults have everything figured out, which they don't, and which they learn when they grow up. But if it is, growing up, these things become a truth. Then you grow up and then you realize, no, there's something wrong. This is not working out the way it's, maybe these were just tools that we used to keep you in order, that are just norms that are built in society, that it's how society functions. A society can't be an element that is completely haywire and questioning all the time. It has to have some consistency. That's why it's society. But when you grow up and you realize that things are not working the way they're supposed to be or the way they were told, then you get a little disillusioned. You realize that everything that you believe to be true until now, things haven't worked out that way. Things don't work out that way. So you start looking for answers. You start looking for, if this is not true, then what? Then you come up with, for me, it was that way. Then I came across people. I realized that if these people are so sure about themselves, then maybe what they're doing is right. And so I read about them. I read about their life. I worshipped them. Because I thought, if I perfectly emulated what they are doing, maybe I'll also reach that place where I'm that confident and sure about myself. But then I realized they're not confident and sure about themselves. They're not confident about what they're saying. They're just brilliant actors. So used to lying to themselves that they've believed it to be true. So then I got a little more disillusioned. Then I was presented with ideas. I thought, let's forget people. I'll just look at ideas. I'll look at what works. I will believe that to be the truth. If somebody tells me the earth is round, which it is, not that I would doubt on that, but just for an example's sake, if somebody tells me the earth is round, and if I find it to be true, then this is the truth. This is what it is. This is how things are. I will never question it again. Now I have something that is very sthir hota hai na, ek tarike se. It's something very still. It's something very truth. But then eventually I realized there is scope beyond that. Ideas don't have to be worshipped. They have to be used when you're to build yourself. Build that template that I was talking about, that template you have to build for yourself. You pick and choose ideas, and then even in those ideas, you don't perfectly apply them to yourself. You engineer them, and then you change them to fit you.
Yeah.
Sometimes in that process, the idea that you pick doesn't even remain the same idea anymore. So that's, ideas cannot be worshipped for me anymore. People cannot be worshipped. Systems cannot be worshipped. I'm building my own template. Whatever is useful to me, I will pick and choose and put it in my template. But that is it.
I think that was a beautiful take. When I read it, it made me think that is a radical point of view. I think I find comfort. As you said, there was a period when I felt a lot of comfort in authorities. And actually, the word worship is literal. Yeah, I just would believe whatever they said, because obviously they know thousands of people follow them. there must be some truth to what you're saying. And then, yeah, then when you see behind the curtains, things are very different. And yeah, but then I haven't arrived at a place where you are speaking from right now, which I still feel like if somebody is presenting good ideas, I think I tend to gravitate towards those people who have good ideas. And I feel there is some merit to those thoughts coming from those people. But yeah, I think you got to be cautious how you want to trust everything they say. So that's a point where self-learning comes into picture.
No, absolutely. And really, Manoj, you don't have to do things the way I do. And I'll tell you why. Because I'm not contending the fact that people don't have ideas or their ideas are not meritorious. However, their ideas are meritorious because they came up with it and it applies to them. Like I said, when I pick those ideas to apply them to myself, I'm coming with too many other unpredictable elements within myself.
Yeah.
I cannot apply it to myself. I have to engineer it. But sometimes it works out perfectly. I went through a process of completely breaking down myself. Everybody doesn't have to go through that. Different ways of learning. This was mine.
Yeah.
It was just, I had to break down myself completely, and now until I'm satisfied with something, I just don't, I cannot apply it to myself. Yeah. I cannot believe it as truth. It's a framework I came up with, but that doesn't have to be the case for anybody else. It comes down to that. Everybody is building their own templates, whether they know it or not. And it doesn't have to fit perfectly with them.
No, totally. I get it. I think these things are something which is so customizable for each individual situation. And I think one of the struggles most of the people who are probably just following the self-help or the self-improvement industry would be that they're trying to fit into the template which has been prescribed, and they just feel this whole conflict of not being good enough. And then the entire journey is about, oh, I'm not good enough, or probably I need to work harder. I need to do something at a different level of commitment. And it's actually a misery that you are actually self-subscribing to.
Absolutely. I think most self-help books are a sham. Most.
Yeah.
That's 99% of them. It's just book selling. It's making money. That's all it is.
Don't kill my potential future business, Priyanka. Like, I have a whole book idea in my mind. A self-help industry to serve. Come on. But you did add the word most. So I think that should be okay. You know?
Yes.
Yeah. So there are some unique ones. Yeah. Okay. Please continue.
100%. For example, Naval.
Yeah.
Naval is somebody who is... I'll tell you why Naval is... So his ideas are so attractive to me. It's because there is 100% transparency. 100%. Okay. When somebody talks about an idea and they're unable to explain it, or it changes in consistency from place to place. And it's not just about the ideas, it's about the person who's presenting those ideas. If there is not transparency, if they would be a different person somewhere else and be a different person in another place, then that's a red flag for me. Especially when it comes to giving advices of self-help. With Naval, it's not really about advices. He's laying the truth as he's experienced it, and with a lot of truth. He's being completely transparent about it. And people, whether they realize this or not, have this knack of recognizing when people are being genuine and true. That is what makes some people more attractive than others. That is what makes some people more to be understood than others, to be followed than others, to be around than others. At any given place and time, for me, I would like to listen to an hour of Naval speaking compared to any other self-help guru. Because I'm looking at complete transparency. I'm going to get the truth as it is. If something didn't work out, it didn't work out. It's not going to be wrapped in pretty words and phrases. And I'm not going to be told, you know what, no matter what, if you persevere, things will go. Sometimes they don't.
They don't, yeah, true.
You have to act smart, and sometimes you have to come up with new solutions.
Yeah. And the funny thing is, so much of that kind of preaching is almost like parroting every other book. And then people tend to parrot these ideas. Consistency is good. Hard work is good. Or these are like very generic, but almost imposed on everybody to abide by, to really make it work.
Yes. It's parroting. It's also people who are looking for help in self-help books. They've already coming to it with a disposition that whatever ideas are presented in this book, I want them to change me and I want them to help me. With that disposition, when you approach something, it's almost like a placebo. You will feel it works for some time, but because it has no substance, you'll eventually realize it was all BS.
Yeah.
So it does tend to happen that way. Then again, I'm not discounting the fact that there are people who have other motivations than just money. There are people who want to put ideas out there. There are people who want to put whatever mechanisms have worked for them out there. I'm not discounting that. I'm just saying, when people wrap things up in these phrases, this is how I did it, and this is how you can do it. I don't read it.
Great. I think I had like two other points which were like a continuity to the earlier point, but then I think you covered it, because I wanted to know about like cultivating confidence and also attribute of being fearless. And to me, you come across as somebody who is willing to ask questions in a as plain and simple way that you would want to ask even somebody that you know. So regardless of the position or the hierarchy, or if you, let's say, you're speaking to Nawal or you're speaking to somebody who's a newcomer, you are willing to ask with zero hesitation. So I was curious, is it a outcome of you being so truthful to yourself that you feel comfortable putting yourself out there, asking questions to anybody? Or is it something which you have honed with practice?
Both. Because I've been truthful to myself for as long as I know. I've lied to myself, naturally, but never to the point where I'm disillusioned about my internal environment. I've been clear in that way. My problem was that it was like two brains existing, two mindscapes existing inside my head. One was totally conforming to things. And this was external. This was happening outside. This was translating into my behavior, my actions, my way of living. But there was another brain that was constantly questioning this. Constantly. And this idea of chaos that people avoid, I have lived with it all my life. I've known it. So I'm not afraid of chaos because of asking questions. I'm not afraid of the consequences that it'll have on me in terms of emotional trauma or anything else. I'm ready to take all of that because asking that question is more important to me. Getting that idea clear is more important to me. So the confidence came from that place, number one, because there was no other way for me except asking that question. The other thing was, even if there was no other way, sometimes it happens that you're too used to a habit, that you used to a way of living. Like I said, two brains existing, two mindscapes exist. One was always conforming, the one that translated into my actions, where I was a yes man for everybody, where I was, I didn't know how to say no. And we discussed the other day, I think.
Yeah.
I didn't know how to say no. I didn't know how to put my thoughts, which always happened to be different from the setting I was in. I didn't know how to put them in front of everybody. At that time, I would avoid chaos. But what I did for that was, when my frustration reached the top level, what I did was I purposefully started asking questions and I started saying things that would disrupt that order and hierarchy. I would piss the other person off. And I really had to do that, because if I didn't, I would not break that mental barrier. So I would piss the other person off by presenting them with my take, even more, in a more harsher way than I would have if I said it naturally. So I did that and I practiced it and I practiced it. And eventually I just became comfortable with saying what was in my mind. I had to break that glass inside my head. These two mindscapes that were existing, they had to merge into one, and the conformity had to go, because that was eating me away. And when I practiced it enough and with enough people, eventually it just came to me now. And even with people like Nawal, you'll see they appreciate people who can talk to them on equal terms.
Absolutely. Like a peer level itself. Yeah.
When you're operating with that kind of mindset, you don't really care about hierarchy.
Yeah.
Because in Naval's own words, that would be a status game, which he's not interested in playing. And in my sense also, getting out of that status game has been very important. So whether it's Naval, whether it's anybody else, it's all the same to me. Naturally, there is quality of ideas, but that is a very subjective thing. That is something that will work for me. Maybe something that Naval says will work for me, it won't work for somebody else. So that quality of ideas, I'm gauging for myself. But in terms of hierarchy, that's really not the thing I think about it.
Priyanka, just one more related question with respect to dealing with people. For example, if somebody very harshly gives you criticism on something, and it's not once, maybe like twice, thrice, but there is merit to their criticism, but you do not like the way, or at least I'll say it for myself. Sometimes the criticism that I receive from some of the closest friends that I have, I find it very hard to process, because I feel like, why are they so critical? They could have been a little more nicer to me. And I am hesitant to present my newer ideas to them the next time, because I know that they're going to just push it down. Do you present these ideas back to the people who give you harsh criticism, or you completely discount them out of your life? How do you process that?
I think that if it is done with somebody's well-being in mind, you're presenting a criticism about somebody's work with the intention to have them improve it, I don't think it will come across as harsh. But if you're making a mockery out of it under the guise of saying that, no, it's for your own good, that's why I said, then really fuck off. I don't care. I can gauge how real a person is being with me.
Yeah, how sincere they are with their, what they're speaking about, right? Yeah.
If they're sincere, for example, very easy. There was a time when I used to be very fat, and I had people make comments on that, which would get to me at the time. I was okay. But then I met my ex-boyfriend after a couple of years when we graduated, and I was still fat. So we went to a cafe. And he said, very normally, he said, you're getting fat. It's not good for your health. At the gym. I could have felt bad about that. I didn't, because I had just internally gauged that he was being very sincere. There was no mockery. There was no presentation in that. He felt concerned. He said, you're getting fat.
Yeah.
Should really hit the gym. And so that was that. We never continued. I took that criticism. I worked hard on myself. Not solely because of what he said, but also it was a positive addition.
Yeah.
Critique, so to say. It was a positive addition. Now here comes somebody who, a supposed friend, okay, who proceeds to make a complete mockery out of me in front of their friends.
Yeah.
Who had gone. And later on says, this is how things change. You have to expose yourself. You have to do this. You have to do that. And that just doesn't make sense to me. Who are you? Are you my parent? Are you God? Why are you taking, what's happening? These are the kind of questions. I start to question their relationship with me, because I think things that are said with sincerity and truth, even if they appear harsh to others, when they're being said to the person who's on the receiving end of that sincerity, it won't feel harsh to them. Things that are a presentation to not the two people in this equation, but to the others around them, to make a show of who's superior in that relationship or in that friendship, I think that can be very easily understood by the person who's on the receiving end of this quote-unquote critique.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, I think few of the friends that really mean, and you can sense it, and it is not something that there is some other evilness to that, but you can definitely feel the sincerity. Yeah, that definitely helps one to really grow. So those are...
At the same time, I'm not saying that people, you won't feel bad about somebody who's a sincere person.
That is not in our control. Yeah, for sure.
Will feel bad, but sometimes you can feel bad.
Yeah.
I tend to not feel bad, but sometimes you can feel bad. Eventually, you'll come to an understanding. It won't leave you with frustration. It will leave you with maybe feeling bad about the way they said it, but it won't leave you with the frustration that, why did they try to humiliate me like that? Okay. It will, eventually you'll come to question yourself. Maybe I can think about it this way. You'll come to that point. When somebody is being insincere, you'll never reach that point, because you know internally that it was not said with that intention.
Wow. We went into some deep discussions there. I want to shift gears a little bit to ask about your creative process. So what drives your creativity? Do you have a structure to that method which ignites your creativity, or do you wait for some kind of inspiration and then you follow that flow? What works for you?
I have no structure when it comes to drawing or creativity or any kind of process. My only good quality in this aspect, I know I could do a lot more in terms of creating a structure for myself in this creative process, which I know would serve me well. But my only good quality is that I observe my surroundings with exceptional detail. I take everything and from every perspective. As far as the environment is concerned, I'm out on walks all the time. I'll have a meal and then I'll be out on a walk and I'll be looking at everything. I don't talk to anyone in that time period. I just look at things. No thought, just plain observation. So most of my creative process can be, the source is this. I'm just simply observing things with exceptional detail. I'm looking at everything. I'm looking at, for example, I'm looking at a squirrel. And I spent 2 hours, which I know many people would consider wasting, but to me it wasn't. I spent 2 hours watching these squirrels fight. And in that process, I developed an understanding of how things work between squirrels. I have to really be interested in drawing something and to think about it creatively. I have to know things about them. I have to know how things work for them. I have to know, we're talking about a live subject here, but let's talk about something like a leaf or something like a stone. I think it will serve me even better when I know the process that stone has been through, where it was hammered. Well, what's the process? I think it will really inspire me to think in new ways. It will lead my brain into branching out with its thoughts. And that always helps me, because so I'll add random elements and I'll work with random colors. It's never in a structure for me, but when I observe something and it inspires me, it's like my hand moves without thinking. That's why observation to me is, thankfully, that thing I have to do. That is something that has served me really well.
Most of us, unless we are deeply interested, I think, we just have a physical level observation of things, and it will be a glancing inspection also. It won't be like a deep observation the way you're saying. And on ordinary mundane things also, there could be so much rich details which we tend to miss. So that's interesting to hear how you approach this. Okay,
my deal is that if there is something I have to do, I have to make it interesting for myself. If it's not, then I don't get the physical, I don't get energized physically to do it. I just can't. Therefore, even if I'm observing mundane things, and I think it's also because of the time that I was isolated, I spent a lot of time with myself. I was viewing sunrises, sunsets, clouds, and just with no thoughts when I'm doing them. It's just simple observation. I'm observing everything. It's a very different kind of feeling, and that helps you come up with very different kind of thoughts when you're in space. So, observation, not simply of your, in a way of a conscious observation, but you have fun looking at things. That's how it is. It's very difficult to get me bored when I'm alone and observing things. I never get bored, ever. I'll get bored with people, but not here.
Do you realize you're in such a great space that way? All the like all the enlightened ones are speaking about the art of just being with yourself, and that is one of the scariest things for a generation which is emerging right now, including us, where we feel the need to constantly be stimulated or doing something. There has to be like something to do, and thanks to our handheld devices, we have something always to do. What you're speaking is a very rare thing that people will experience or will even take time to do, unless I remember the good old days when there is a power cut, especially in India. That is when actually you actually come together as a family, you sing, you do fun things, you play with shadows, you do things with candles.
Yes.
It is be a very interesting time. And today we have UPS backup. There's no power cuts. I think the only time when family unites is when Wi-Fi is down, maybe. I don't know. So
yeah, it's a pity. But I think people born in different ages and different times, they have their own pros and cons to deal with. I think in terms of focusing simply on the creative process and building and ideas, I think the people who are being born today have a much larger scope with that.
Oh, they do. Yeah. Mm.
At the same time, I feel very lucky to have been born in a time where there was practically no technology. Because I know what it feels like to connect people in that way. That is something that I get to experience. I also get to experience technologies. So for me, it's been the best of both worlds.
Yeah. I know that you have a passion for history and especially Indian history. You're really good. I wanted to ask you, is there any lesser known stories or misunderstandings which you believe deserves more attention from the history perspective? A story maybe which has been narrated in a certain way, but actually there is a completely different angle to it.
Oh, wow. This is everything, actually. history as it's told to the world is just...
This deserves a complete separate episode, you're saying. Like, this is...
Absolutely. 100%. When Indian history is, see, it's got a lot to do with European colonialism. It's got to do a lot with Islamic invasions. It's got a lot to do with so many things that happened to us instead of what was happening on this land organically. So that's somehow it's been lost, even though that's where this land draws its ancient roots from. That's been forgotten, but history as it's presented to the world is mostly just politics. Mm. It's political in nature. You never get to hear people talking about the Indus Valley civilization anymore, which is one of the biggest mysteries of our time because its language has not been deciphered. Imagine the kind of secrets it's hiding. It is mind-blowing to me. It's one of my wishes. In my lifetime, at least, I wish that language, that code, to be deciphered. I want to know what was written. But with history, it gets tough because we've interacted with so many other civilizations. The way history is told to us in India is not the same way it will be told to the Brits in Britain. For them, it will be something else. So it's tough to pinpoint what's been misunderstood and misinterpreted. But in terms of stories, in terms of things that we did organically here that didn't happen to us,
yeah.
There was a time before any social, political structure came to be in India, a time of Mahajanpadas. The first time people formed communities and made them into larger kingdoms, which is where Mahabharata is generally traced from. We have the Gandhar kingdom, where we have Shakuni, we have Indraprastha, there are fantastic stories from that time. There are stories of marriages, because the social setup was so different. Mm-hmm. There are stories of marriages, there are stories of wars, but ultimately it all comes together and gets tied up in a single thread. And it's fascinating to see how that interconnects. So I would encourage people to look at that. I would also encourage people to read more about the Indus Valley civilization, because there is so much to learn, but more importantly, there's just so much to admire in the Indus Valley civilization. Urban cities today with absolutely trash sewerage systems. But at that time, they had carved out a city perfectly with sewage systems, with water outlets. And it's a marvel of urban planning at that time. So definitely, I would encourage people to read more about that. But history, when it's politicized from 8th BC, onwards, when the invasions start happening, it's just most of the things get lost. Nobody remembers the name of Gurjar Pratiharas or Satvahanas or Rashtrakut.
I have no idea who you're referring to also, see.
These are all dynasties which held great power, which have built most of the architecture of India, most ancient architecture. But nobody remembers them. We'll be talking of Mughals, we'll be talking of Marathas because they're recent to our memory. Or else they would be lost as well. But nobody's talking about the Pandav dynasty, or the Chola dynasty or the Chera dynasty or the Pals, the Gurjar Pratiharas. So we have marvelous things to study in history, which somehow received no interest of historians, which is very suspicious to me. I don't like it, but what can be done? At the same time, there are entire universities, the Nalanda University, the kind of ancient knowledge it housed, and when it was burned down, what was lost? Some there's no talk about that. The Takshashila way that went from the center of India all the way up to Northwest. It was a very vibrant trade route. Very vibrant. It was also the first university of Bharat at that time. So many things lost in history, which is unfortunately at this time very, in this podcast, very difficult to convey to
people. Yeah, totally. But, yeah. No, I know that my question was too broad to address, but how do you suggest people study history? History always came across to me as a very boring subject, maybe thanks to the education system we have, or my lack of interest in the subject. But if somebody was really interested, how would you suggest they approach that? We have standard textbooks, but if you were to get unique perspectives or maybe closer to the truth, how should one approach that?
Number one, discard all the standard textbooks. They're absolutely useless. They are usually written with a political motive, and this can be from any side. Discard all standard textbooks. Start from the complete beginning where there could have been no political motive. Start from the ancient civilizations of the world and then try to interconnect them. To interconnect the time the Mesopotamian civilization existed to the Aztec civilization, to the Indus civilization, what kind of trade was happening there? Learn about that. But after that, learn and read all the books that were banned. Anything that's been banned by the government, read it. Read all of it. Because there is something that they don't want you to know. Why? You're a witness in this country, witnessing the events in this country. Why are you not supposed to read that information? As if somehow you cannot handle it. That's absolute bullshit. Just read everything that the government bans. And start getting your idea from there. Take in both perspectives, because there are narratives existing in this country. Try to take in information from both and be a judge for yourself. When you read that information, be a judge for yourself what feels right and what feels wrong. At that time, you will start getting a fair idea about history.
Wow, I think I really like the idea about looking at the banned books. Something very interesting. Yeah, I didn't 100%. Think about that though. Wow. And in the recent times, is there something that you have made a significant shift in your point of view about it? Like where you discovered a new understanding about it and you completely let go of the old belief and subscribing to the new belief based on the new information you have?
Yes. Very recently, actually 2 years ago, I read this book, India That Is Bharat by J. Sai Deepak. And the astonishing attention to detail in the way things unfolded after 1947 and before 1947, what led up to it. It's something that opened my eyes. Very literally, my eyes are wide agape. Wide open when I was reading that book, because most of the times I couldn't believe the information that was written. But when it's provided with evidence, it's hard to ignore it. So yeah, that's something that changed the way I viewed the world around me significantly.
That may be many ideas, but something which stood out for you from that book?
There was this, for example, the origin of the word secular and where it comes from. And what secularism means today versus what are its origins and how has the word evolved? When secularism was a conversation happening within the Christian fold, how did it come to mean something that is equidistant from religion? That journey itself and that change, most people will not be aware that secularism is something that meant having a secular ruler, a secular nation that still believed in Christ. Only it did have Pope as authority. The Protestants, those were seculars, but they were still religious. How did that word come to mean irreligious? How did that word come to mean a place where you're equally involved in all religions or equidistant from all directions. That is something that opened my eyes. But there's just, there's 100 others and more enlightening things that's been said in that book.
Okay, I think we'll put that in the show notes as link for people to read up in case they're interested. Tell me about something that, you know, it isn't widely known about you, but you wish people knew that this is Priyanka. So is there something that you wish more people knew about you?
I'll be honest, I wish people forgot about me the moment they don't see me in front of them. Everything about me. A clean slate every time we meet. I don't wish people to know anything about me. Nothing. Absolutely.
Wow, that's deep, Priyanka. So are you saying that you do not want them to have any perceived ideas about you? Like every time they meet you, it should be clean slate? Wouldn't that be like too much of a work for you to establish who you are?
See, that's the thing. I don't want to establish who I am. If I'm meeting someone, it's just conversations. That's all. I don't want to think about, because when I start knowing a person, my focus shifts from what they're talking about with me to who they are. And when it's who they are, then I have to be very careful in who I associate with. Because when I'm looking at somebody's who they are, there are things that will not fit well with me. That is why I'm a loner. That is why I have nobody to hang out with.
No, so Priyanka, what does relationship mean to you? Does it mean something to you? Does relationships matter to you?
Relationships in the romantic sense or just generally?
In any sense, you could have a romantic partner. You could have somebody who's a very close friend. So if you're going with this kind of an approach, I feel the other person obviously has to be at that level of thinking and understanding to know that, hey, there is that element of being absolutely blunt about what you feel about the other person to say, and it could hurt the relationship or it could hurt them, and you don't want to just feel like you're walking on eggshells when you're actually dealing with people.
That is actually the most important thing to me. I don't want to feel like I'm walking on eggshells, therefore I don't care about how the other, and people may not consider this very nice, but I don't care about what the other person feels, because I'm approaching them with sincerity. If I'm engaging with them, I'm confident about this for myself. I always approach people with sincerity. If I don't see that being reciprocated, or if I'm just not enjoying the conversation, I'll be very upfront about it, at least at this age and this stage in my life. Any person who needs to understand who I am already knows it, my family. There is nobody else in the world that I care to put in the effort for them to get to know me. I'm very comfortable right now. And I don't feel that need. So friendships, I think if you find a good friend in your life, I think you're extremely lucky. And I think it's one of the best things to have. But me personally, if I come across a person who I want to be good friends with, that's that. But that's it. For me, that is it. It's not like I'm going to place that friendship on the top of my priority list. That's not going to happen. It's going to be a space where we both enjoy, and considering that I'm becoming friends with them, I'm sure they would be taking a similar view. I don't want to put in that mental baggage. Acquired relationships. When I'm
Sorry, please proceed.
No, it's okay. What are you asking?
No, I was just stating that the fact that somebody who has you as a friend, it is very liberating friendship in that sense also. I feel, or it would be extremely opposite. So if I know that you are going to be so low maintenance to interact with because there is no baggage, that is very liberating actually. You can actually speak to that friend, and if you have a friend like that, it's amazing. So I think that's great. But that's not common, right? So yeah, that's the case.
It's not. And naturally, I've not been this person for all my life. I'm becoming this person.
Yeah.
And let's say I've become this person, at least the scenario that I described to you, at least that stage I've reached. But I wasn't always this person. I had a childhood friend. We were friends for 15 years. But like I said, I was a yes man. I was a conformist. I never used to speak my mind. When I started to speak my mind with her, she felt like it was a violation of her rights.
Yeah.
And eventually, this is a 16-year friendship that I'm talking about, because it just wasn't worth it. I had lots of fun times with her, but a greater amount of mental baggage. See, especially in friendships or any relationship that you acquire, the interaction always has to be as equals. it cannot be a single person's framework operating the entire relationship. That's just not the way it works. Not for me, at least. So, broke my friendship with that person. Then I hung out with a couple of friends. I thought we were, because at that place, I had a little more freedom.
Yeah.
I gave myself a little more freedom to express. But it was a bad place in the sense it was all about drinking and smoking. And and that's fine for a little while, but it didn't satiate me. Eventually, I had a fallout with them as well. None of my fault. They just, I don't know, they didn't like something I said. So things, we had a fallout after that in any case. So since then, I've been very choosy about, it's just come naturally to me. I don't look for people to hang out with.
Yeah.
Comfortable in my company. I talk with people. I'm talking with you right now. Yeah. Conversations are all that matter to me. As long as I'm having a good conversation, it's all that matters to me. I don't want to find anything else about that person because I'm not looking for something. All I'm looking for is a good conversation.
No, this is great. I think, as I told you, this is very refreshing to hear. I remember this was many years back. I went for a 15 days retreat. It was like a silent retreat and it was very intense, where one of the things was required for us to do was to look at our own ugliness in us. Look, like if you have a certain image about who you are and you perceive and start believing that I'm good, I'm a really nice guy, you start looking at your own darker side and you discover, you know what, you have the good side and you also have this dark side which you probably never paid attention to. That was a very difficult acceptance for me at that stage, to know that, hey, you know what, I am actually envious about somebody. There are things which I probably never acknowledged about myself, and that put me in front of my own darker side. And then when I came out of that retreat, I didn't feel any reason to lie to anybody. I felt almost compelled to tell people the truth as is. And that exercise didn't go that great. I lost a couple of friends, and you know, people used to ask me. No. But I'm gonna just come back to how I had to make course corrections to survive. And you are really bold, so I will tell you what I had to do. So I was very transparent with people and my interactions, and they found it so not right. Like, they said, something is really wrong. You can't be so rude. I said, I'm telling you what it is. I'm not gonna sugarcoat. I'm telling you what exactly I feel about this situation or about you or about this feedback. And after a period of time, I started noticing it was not helping me operate in the world smoothly, actually. And the problem was, I was not comfortable with that conflict within myself to operate so much with resistance from the world. Then I realized that I'm not going to actually voice out what I feel. I'm going to be true to what I feel internally, but I'm not going to express it to the other person, because it is not necessary to really voice out what I feel to the other person. So that is where I concluded to, if somebody were to ask me anything specifically, I may be just polite, but I may not give all the details to the extent where it could offend them. You understand? So I obviously am editing my responses to survive. So that is where it is right now. So
it's less chaotic. Just know what the truth is yourself. You don't have to express it to people. That does result in less chaos, but I am compulsive that way.
I exist
in settings where somebody is conversing with me through their body language, and passively they're trying to say something else, but through their mouth they're uttering different words. It irritates me in a way nothing else does. So I have to let
them. It's just not congruent with their body language and what they say. And
like I said, I observe things with astonishing detail. So for me, it's a mental overload. Be that person that your body language is saying, or be this person what your face is saying.
Don't
be both at the same time. It's
mental. Be aligned.
So that's the kind of thing I've evolved into. I left my job in the corporate world because that place is fake as fuck. Nobody is saying what they mean. Everybody is just, they're making connections because they need to survive in each other's company. I can't do that.
You know, it's a facade for sure. It's like almost like a choreography that everybody plays their part to.
Especially buddy companies, which is why I admire Naval and the team HR, because they're all coming together, they're expressing ideas, they're doing trial and error, they're working on it. It's such a, that's the kind of environment that makes you want to work.
Yeah, yeah.
But go into an office, sit in a uniform, have lunch, talk with each other. For me, that became, so I know there are offices that exist that have a brilliant environment. I know this personally. At the same time, I also know there are people who train themselves and who become skillful in conversing in these situations as well. I consider it a great skill.
Yeah.
For me, I'm just not skilled in that department.
You don't choose to be, basically. Yeah, it's not just not skilled. You just don't want to participate in that.
I've had an alarming, even to myself, resistant towards things that make me choose discomfort. Jeans, for example.
Mm.
I didn't like how they felt when I wore them. And I've never worn jeans. No matter how trendy they were, no matter how good they felt, I've never worn jeans. I just can't. So that's the mindset I'm coming from now.
No, it's very refreshing. So I think
whatever in my environment feels like jeans to me, I just let it be. Don't be okay. People should not be jeans.
Okay, I think we have come a long way. I think we'll probably should have a round two to go a little more into some of the other things that you're really good at, which I'm not doing justice in this particular episode.
Yes, excited.
Yeah. I want to touch upon, on the almost at the closing part, where why don't you tell me, I think you definitely listen to a wide range of genres of music. So I wanted to know, what's your preferred artist like, and are there any specific tracks or albums that you would like to share with us?
I listen to a lot of music, and I listen to every kind of music, every kind. It doesn't matter what language it is. It doesn't matter who's making it, but I like to be very, how should I put it? Very, I like to have variety in what I listen to.
Yeah.
Especially when I'm discovering music. But I'll say I listen to every type of music. The most played song that I listen to is Ahista by Pankaj Udas. It's a ghazal. City pop does the work for me. City pop is great when I'm working. It's great when I'm in a mood to chill. It sets the environment for me anywhere, anytime. For albums, they most certainly will be city pop. I also like old Bollywood. I like the songs from Guide. I like the songs from Badosan, Kishore Kumar, Mohammad Rafi. Great singers. There were simple melodies, simple lyrics. And that's why I think they're timeless. They were not so complicated in the things they were including, which doesn't seem to be the case today, at least in Bollywood music. Folk music. I think folk music is music for my soul, especially when I'm listening to it live.
Oh, have you gone to these live folk music concerts and all that?
Not concerts, but I've gone to something even better. I had the opportunity to, sit with some nomads in the desert on the Delhi highway. And their life is just, wow. They're living very differently. They sit together, they work together. And then in the night, they'll take out their instruments, iktara.
Yeah.
Very different kind of instruments. And then they'll just dance and sing the night away. And the music, the kind of music you hear there is music for the soul. Nowhere else in the world can you listen to that kind of music. No curated music. It's just all coming on the spot, but it's so in sync. It looks like it's prepared, but it's not.
Yeah. And some of the most undetected talents exist in such setup also, right? Like, we will never get to see them on a media platform or anywhere, but they are out there actually doing their thing.
I'm thankful for that, because the moment it becomes about a performance that you need to give to people and not something that you enjoy, it ruins the very nature of it. I'll give you an example. BTS, it's a very popular boy band, Korean boy band.
Yeah.
In today's world. So I discovered them when they hadn't debuted at that point of time. They were young kids. They were all very raw, and they'd come from the underground scene. So that made them more special than others, because they were actually participating in the music that they were making. They were producing it, not simply picking one song from mass-produced tracks.
Yeah.
So that was very different to me. I started listening to them they were making some great music. The Spring Day, Save Me, and many other such tracks. They were just, there's Lie by one of their members. They were good tracks. They represented what they could uniquely bring to the table. They presented it in a good way.
Yeah.
But now comes a time after one track of theirs, Blood, Sweat, and Tears, goes viral across the globe. And then they just blew up from there. And they catch on to these phrases like self-love, all of this nonsense.
The positive, the whole thing, correct.
So they pick onto this and they make it their brand. Whatever made them unique,
yeah,
is now lost.
Yeah.
Now they're like every other artist who's already present in the West. They're singing in English, even though they're not comfortable. Why? Sing in your own language, if that is what you're comfortable in. Sing in English.
So the originally when they started, they weren't singing in English. That's what you're saying?
No, they were singing in Hangul. They were singing in Korean.
Okay. I didn't know about that. Okay.
And imagine that. Nobody understands what you're saying, but they're still listening to you so intently. What kind of music are you making? You're making very good music.
Yeah.
But if people don't want to listen to you when they finally start to understand you.
Yeah.
It's something's changed. Now they're just, they've just rebranded themselves as these West-like artists. The West does West well because that's what they are. You do you. Change yourself.
Yeah.
It makes you lose the unique factor you brought to the table. Now they're no longer interesting to me.
Even though
now they've blown up across the globe. They're definitely much more popular than they were at the time.
That is interesting. Yeah.
To overuse this word, they just don't feel authentic anymore.
Yeah, so that's why you said some of these performers, it's better they're undiscovered because 100%. The art.
they're doing it purely for enjoyment. It's something they're doing because it's coming from inside. I feel like singing, I'll just hit a note right now.
Yeah.
Then you sit in a studio, then there are 15 other people telling you what to do.
Yeah.
You're taking a sir note. No, don't take it at that. Take it at sir. Go there. So that's just not real. There are some people who are well suited to that environment. I know there are playback singers like Shreya Ghoshal. What brilliant talent. Arijit Singh in today's time. Mohammed Rafi, Kishore Kumar.
Yeah.
So there is brilliant talent that can come out in playback singers. But people who exist in the wild, and by wild, undiscovered.
Yeah. Let them be. Yeah, basically.
Local folk music. They're just, it's like meditation. Meditation is not performative. It's just happening, you know?
Yeah.
That's why
they're better
undiscovered.
Okay, we shall conclude with one last question. Are there any books which has had profound, you know, impact on your worldview about things? But are there any two or three books that you would like to share?
Yes, I did mention one of those. India, that is Bharat, J. Sai Deepak.
Yeah.
There is, in history, for example, I had Sitaram Goyal's Hindu temples and what happened to them. There is The Flight of the Deities. It gave me a more nuanced understanding of what went on in the medieval times. But probably the book that has helped me most, which was not a book in its original form, it was a deliverance, is the Bhagavad Gita. It is like a guide to life because it's a dialogue. The entire book is a dialogue happening between Arjun, who you can call the seeker, and between God, which is the divine. The seeker and what he's seeking, they both come on the same plane, and the seeker is just asking away questions about everything there is, about his fears, about the world, about whatever it is that is stopping him, about his dharma, righteousness, karma, everything in the world. And that divine is sitting there answering you. So it's like a guide to life. I go back to it multiple times. So there's been that.
Is there a version of Bhagavad Gita that you would recommend as a starting point to read? Is there a specific, I'm sure there are so many variants to it. Is there one that you would like to recommend?
I try to read things in their original language because I think much is lost in translation. And I think that is always going to be the case. But for somebody who only speaks English, they can go for Eknath Ishwaran's Bhagavad Gita. Although
it may not do justice in its totality.
But I think it comes pretty close. So Eknath Tuskaran's version of the Bhagavad Gita.
Okay, cool. All right, Priyanka, what do you want the world to remember you for? What is the impact that you want to really leave? And you may just answer, say, I don't want to leave any impact, but I want you to think about it and tell me, if people were to talk about you, do you care what they speak, or do you wish that there is a certain message that you leave on this planet?
Let me tell you a little story about this. There is Swami Vivekananda, who philosophy's practitioner.
Mm-hmm.
He was responsible for consolidating the philosophies of Hinduism in the modern age. I think after Sri Adi Shankaracharya in the ancient times, this is the first person who's consolidated Hinduism the way he has. And he had this book called Karma Yoga. And one of the things that he says in that is, the greatest of men that have lived on this earth, nobody knows them. But even if they will speak very less, they are the closest you can be to the truth, to the objective reality as it exists. But even if they sit inside a cave in a mountain, completely isolated from the world, whatever 4 words, 5 words they speak will penetrate those mountains, and those ideas will reach. And through the generations, they will manifest in a Buddha or in Jesus or in any other god that you believe in. So, to disappoint you, Manoj, I truly do not want to be remembered for anything I did. I have no such desire.
I am not surprised. Yeah.
I want to do things right by myself first. I really have nothing. I'm not thinking that far ahead. I don't want to be remembered. I don't want to do things for the sake of being remembered.
Beautiful. I think Priyanka, I really love you as a person, and I totally enjoy conversing with you, and I found you very interesting from the beginning, so I'm so glad that you agreed to come on the show. And
thank you for having me, Manoj. Thank you for tolerating me.
No, this is really good. I think this is the beginning of maybe many such conversations in the future. So I'm going to probably, if I'm doing something on Indian history and I want somebody to handhold me, you are the person I'm going to be calling. So be ready for that.
Oh, I am. No worries. You'll be ready for the time. You'll be ready for what I will say after that.
Yeah. All right. Is there anything else finally you want to share? And where can people find you online? And if they want to check out your work, and is there a newsletter that people can subscribe? Is there any online coordinates that you want to share?
So I have a profile on Twitter. That's perhaps where I have most of my following. There is a link to my Substack in that. I'm not very regular yet, but I've begun writing on the advice of a good friend, credit Andrea. And I have an Instagram, but for my art, where you can look at my work. I also have an air chat where we can converse, which is something that I highly and deeply value. So these are my coordinates.
Awesome. I think we'll put all of them in the show notes. And any other final thoughts before we conclude?
Yes. Thank you for being such a great host. I had lots of fun today. It's always nice to me when I get a platform where I can speak my thoughts unfiltered. And it's more exciting that this is going to reach people in the audio format.
Yeah.
So thank you for making my first podcast experience so nice and so comfortable. I had great fun. Thanks.
Awesome. Thank you. Thank you, Priyanka. All right, that concludes this episode. Hopefully you had fun listening to it. If you really want to get access to the show notes, make sure to go to my website, www.rareearth.com. That is www.rareerth.com. Yeah, it does not have an A in it. And you could also subscribe to my weekly newsletter, which is called as One Idea. Once you're on my website, you can see a link to subscribe to the newsletter as well. That's it for now. See you on the next episode.